Every time he tried to tear down the hot wire with his tusks to get closer to his mother, he got an electric shock. Of course, every time he squealed in pain, Wimpy had to hear it and see it. Nevi looked up at me. An elephant can't commit suicide, but I'm pretty sure Wimpy was trying her damnedest. In the wild, a female elephant would not separate from her male calf until he was 10 to 13 years old. To be artificially separated, forced to see a baby in distress and unable to do anything about it. Well, I thought of Laredo, charging down the hill to stand over the body of Kenosi. I thought of grief in elephants and how maybe a loss was not always synonymous with a death. Before I even realized what I was doing, I crossed my arms over my abdomen. I prayed for a miracle, and one day, Thomas Metcalf arrived. The bastard brothers wanted to get rid of Wimpy because they figured she was close to dying anyway, and now that they had her calf, they didn't need her. Thomas sold his car to pay a rental trailer to transport Wimpy up north. She was the first elephant at this sanctuary.
I thought it was Sira.
Well, Nevi said, that's also true, because Wimpy passed 2 days after she got here. It was too late for her. I like to think that at least she knew when she died she was safe.
What about her baby?
We didn't have the resources here to take on a male elephant.
But surely you've tracked what happened to him.
That calf is an adult male now, somewhere, Nevi said. It's not a perfect system, but we do what we can.
I looked at Wanda, delicately dipping a toe into the water of the pond, while Sira patiently blew bubbles under the water. As I watched, Wanda waded in, splashing at the surface with her trunk, sending up a fountain of spray.
Thomas may know, Nevi said, after a moment.
About what?
Her face was smooth, unreadable. About that baby, she replied.
Then she picked up the bucket of rinds and slop and headed up the hill to the garden, as if she had only been speaking of elephants. The arrival of Mora, the new elephant, had been pushed up a week, throwing the entire sanctuary into a tornado of preparation. I pitched in where I could, trying to help get the African enclosure ready to host its second elephant. In the frenzy, the last thing I expected to find was Gideon in the Asian barn giving Wanda a pedicure. He sat on a stool on the outside of the stall, the elephant's front right foot poking through an open trap in the steel grid, resting on a girder. Gideon hummed as he used an X-Acto knife on the pads on the bottom of her foot, shaving away the calluses and trimming the cuticles. For such a big man, I thought, he was surprisingly gentle.
Please tell me she gets to pick a nail polish color, I said, coming up behind him, hoping I could start a conversation that would erase the unfortunate way we had met. Foot-related diseases kill half the elephants in captivity, Gideon said. Joint pain, arthritis, osteomyelitis. Try standing on concrete for the next 60 years.
I crouched down. So you do preventative care?
We file down the cracks, keep rocks from getting caught, do foot soaks in apple cider for abscesses.
He jerked his chin toward the stall so that I would notice Wanda's left front foot immersed in a big rubber tub.
One of our girls even had giant sandals made by Teva with rubber bottoms to help with the pain.
I would never have imagined this was a concern for elephants, but then again, the elephants I knew had the benefit of rough terrain to naturally condition their feet. They had limitless space to exercise stiff joints.
"She's so calm," I said. "It's like you've hypnotized her."
Gideon ignored the compliment.
"She wasn't always like this. When she first came, she was full of beans. She'd drink up a trunk full of water, and when you got close enough to the stall, she'd spray the whole load at you. She threw sticks," he glanced at me, "like Hester, but with less impressive aim."
I felt my cheeks redden. "Yes, I'm sorry about that."
"Grace should have told you. She knows better."
"It wasn't your wife's fault." Something flickered across Gideon's features. Regret? Annoyance? I did not know him well enough to read his expression. At that moment, Wanda pulled back her foot. She snaked her trunk through the bars of the stall and overturned the bowl of water sitting beside Gideon, soaking his lap. He sighed, righted the bowl, and said,
"Foot here."
Wanda lifted her leg again for him to finish.
"She likes to test us," Gideon said. "I guess she's always been that kind of elephant. But where she came from, if she acted out like that, she'd get beaten. If she refused to move, she got pushed around by a bobcat. When she first arrived, she'd bang on the bars, making a huge racket, like she was daring us to punish her. And we'd all cheer her on and tell her to make even more noise."
Gideon patted Wanda's foot, and she delicately pulled it back inside the stall. She stepped out of the cider bath, lifted the tub with her trunk, dumped the liquid down a drain, and handed it to Gideon. Startled, I laughed. "I guess now she's a model of propriety."
"Not quite. She broke my leg a year ago. I was tending to her hind foot when I got stung by a hornet. I jerked my hand up, and something about the way I hit her on the bottom must have spooked her. She reached through the bars with her trunk and smacked me against them, over and over, like she was having some kind of bad trip. Took Dr. Metcalf and my mother-in-law both to get Wanda to put me down so they could tend to me," he said. "3 clean breaks in my femur."
"You forgave her?"
"Wasn't her fault,"
Gideon flatly replied.
"She can't help what's been done to her. In fact, it's incredible that she lets anyone close enough to touch her after all that."
I watched him cue Wanda to turn, to present her other front foot.
"It's amazing," Gideon said, "what they're willing to excuse."
I nodded, but I was thinking of Grace, who had wanted to be a teacher and wound up scraping elephant dung off the barn floors. I wondered if these elephants, which had become accustomed to a cage, could recall the person who had first put them into it. I watched Gideon tap Wanda's foot so that she pulled it away from the gap in the fencing and rocked the fat pad on the floor of the barn, testing his handiwork. And I thought, not for the first time, that forgiving and forgetting aren't mutually exclusive. When Mora arrived, the trailer was parked inside the African enclosure. Hester was nowhere nearby. She had been grazing in the northernmost corner of the property. The trailer had been dropped along the southern edge. For 4 hours, Grace and Nevi and Gideon had tried to coax Mora out, bribing her with watermelon, apples, and hay. They had played the tambourine, hoping that the noise would interest her. They had piped classical music through portable speakers, and when that failed, classic rock. "Has this ever happened before?" I whispered as I stood next to Thomas.
He looked exhausted. There were circles beneath his eyes, and I don't think he'd actually managed to sit through an entire meal in the 2 days since he'd gotten word that Mora was en route.
We've had drama. When Olive was brought here by her circus trainer, she sauntered out of the trailer and walloped him twice before she went off into the woods. I have to tell you, though, the guy was a jerk. Olive just did what all of us were thinking of doing. But all the others, they were either too curious or too cramped to stay in the trailer for very long.
The night was coming violently, clouds screaming with crimson throats. It would get cold and dark soon. If we were going to stay and wait, we would need lanterns, floodlights, blankets. I had no doubt this was Thomas's plan. It was what I would have done, what I had done when I was observing transition in the wild, not from captivity to sanctuary, but at birth or death.
"Gideon," Thomas began, about to issue instructions, when there was a rustle at the tree line.
I had been surprised hundreds of times by elephants that traveled soundlessly and swiftly in the bush. I should not have been as startled as I was by the appearance of Hester. She moved almost too quickly for an animal of her size, light on her feet and excited by this big, foreign metal object in her enclosure. Thomas had told me that the elephants became animated if a bulldozer was brought in to do excavation or landscape work. They were curious about things bigger than themselves. Hester began to cross back and forth in front of the trailer ramp. She rumbled a hello. This went on for about 10 seconds. When she didn't get a response, it evolved into a short roar. From inside the trailer came a rumble. I felt Thomas's hand reach for mine. Mora gingerly walked down the ramp, her body in silhouette, pausing halfway. Hester stopped moving back and forth. Her rumbles escalated into a roar, a trumpet, and then a rumble. The same cacophonous joy I'd heard when elephants that had been separated from their herd were reunited. Hester lifted her head and flapped her ears rapidly. Mora urinated and began to secrete from her temporal glands. She inched her trunk toward Hester, but still would not come fully down that ramp. Both elephants continued to rumble as Hester put her front 2 feet onto the ramp and turned her head until her torn ear was close enough for Mora to touch. Then Hester lifted her front left foot, presented it to Mora. It was as if she was telling her life story. "Look at how I was hurt. Look at how I survived." Watching this, I started to cry. I felt Thomas's arm come around me as Hester finally curled her trunk around Mora's. She let go, backing off the ramp as Mora tentatively followed.
"Imagine being part of a traveling circus," Thomas said, his voice tight. "That's the last time she'll ever have to walk out of a trailer."
The two elephants swayed in tandem, moving toward the tree line. They were so close that they seemed to be one giant mythical creature, and as the night puckered close around them, I struggled to distinguish the elephants from the thicket where they vanished.
"Well, Mora," Nevi murmured, "welcome to your forever home."
There were a lot of explanations I could give for the decision I made at that moment. That the elephants in this sanctuary needed me more than the elephants in the wild did. That I was starting to think the work I had built my scholarship around was not limited by geographic borders. That the man holding my hand, like me, had been brought to tears by the arrival of a rescued elephant. But none of these were the reason. When I first went to Botswana, I had been chasing knowledge, fame, a way to contribute to my field. But now, as my circumstances had changed, my reasons for being in that game reserve had too. Lately, my arms hadn't been outstretched to embrace my work. They'd been pushing away thoughts that scared the hell out of me. I wasn't running toward my future anymore. I was running away from everything else. A forever home. I wanted that. I wanted that for my baby. It was so dark now that, like the elephants, I couldn't see and had to find my way with my other senses. So I framed his face with my hands, breathed in the scent of him, touched my forehead to his. "Thomas," I whispered, "I have something to tell you."
Virgil. What tipped me off was that stupid pebble. The minute Thomas Metcalf saw it, he went ballistic. Okay, granted, it wasn't exactly the gold standard for sanity. But the minute he focused on that necklace, there was a clarity in his eyes that had not been there when we first walked into the room. Rage often brings out the real person. Now, sitting in my office, I pop yet another Tums into my mouth. I think this is my 10th. Not that I'm really counting, because I can't seem to get rid of the fizzy pressure in my chest. I've chalked it up to heartburn from that crap we ate for lunch from the hot dog cart. But there's a tiny, fleeting thought that maybe this isn't a gastric issue at all. Maybe it's just pure, unadulterated intuition. A nervous hunch. Which I have not felt in a very, very long time. My office is covered with evidence. In front of each box taken from the PD, there are several paper bags tipped onto their sides, with the contents carefully arranged in a semicircle beneath them. A flowchart of crime, a felonious family tree. I am careful where I step, making sure that I don't crush a brittle leaf with a black spot of blood on it, or overlook a small paper packet with a fiber inside. I'm thankful for my own inefficiency at that moment. Our evidence room was full of material that could have or should have been returned to its owners, but never was, either because the investigating officer never told the property officer the items could be destroyed or returned, or because the property officer wasn't involved in the investigations and wouldn't have known that information on his own. After Nevi Rule's death was ruled accidental, my partner had retired and I had either forgotten or subconsciously decided not to tell Ralph to remove the boxes. Maybe, on some level, I wondered whether Gideon might file a civil suit against the sanctuary. Or maybe, on some level, I wondered about Gideon's role that night. Whatever the reason, I'd known that I'd need to comb through these boxes again. It's true that, if you want to get technical, I've been fired from this case. Except that Jenna Metcalf is a 13-year-old kid who probably changed her mind 6 times this morning before she decided on a breakfast cereal. She threw words at me like handfuls of mud. And now that they've dried, I can brush them off. It's true, too, that I'm not sure if the death of Nevi Rule was caused by Thomas or his wife, Alice. I suppose Gideon can't be ruled out either now. If he was sleeping with Alice, his mother-in-law might not have been all too happy. I just don't believe the death was a trampling, even if I signed off on that 10 years ago. But if I'm going to figure out who the murderer is, first I need proof that this was a murder. Thanks to Tallulah and the lab, I know that Alice Metcalf's hair was found on the victim. But did she find Nevi's body after the trampling and leave that hair behind before she ran? Or was she the reason there was a body in the first place? Could the hair transfer have been innocent, as Jenna wanted to believe? 2 women who brushed by each other in the office earlier that morning, neither one knowing that by the end of the day, one of them would be dead? Alice is, of course, the key. If I could find her, I'd have my answers. What I know about her is that she ran away. People who run away either have something they're trying to reach or something they're trying to avoid. I'm just not sure, in this case, which one it was. But either way, why not take her daughter with her? I hate saying that Serenity might be right about anything, but it would be considerably easier if Nevi Rule were around to tell me what happened that night. "Dead men don't talk," I mutter out loud.
"I beg your pardon?"
Abigail, my landlady, scares the shit out of me. All of a sudden, she's standing in the doorway, frowning at the paraphernalia strewn around the office.
"Fuck, Abby! Don't sneak up on me like that!" "Must you use that word?"
"Fuck," I repeat. "I don't know what you've got against it. It can be a verb, an adjective, a noun. It's very versatile." I smile broadly at her. She sniffs at the detritus on the floor.
"I'll remind you that each tenant is responsible for his own refuse collection."
"This isn't trash. It's work." Abigail's eyes narrow.
"It looks like a crystal moth lab."
"First of all, it's meth." Her hands flutter at her throat.
"I knew it."
"No," I say, "just trust me, okay?
This looks nothing like a crystal meth lab. This is all evidence from a case."
Abigail puts her hands on her hips.
"You've already used that excuse."
I blink at her. And then I remember. One time, when I'd been on a bender not long ago, and had been wallowing in my own stink for a full week without leaving the office, Abigail had come to investigate. When she walked in, I was passed out cold on my desk, and the place looked like a bomb had gone off. I told her I'd been up working all night and must have dozed off. I told her that the litter on the floor was physical evidence collected by the Major Crimes Unit. Although really, when was the last time you saw the MCU gather empty bags of microwave popcorn and old Playboys?
"Have you been drinking, Victor?"
"No," I say. And with no small sense of wonder, I realize that the thought has not even crossed my mind in the past 2 days. I don't want a drink. I don't need one. Jenna Metcalf hasn't just ignited a spark of purpose in me. She's managed to dry me out, cold turkey, the way 3 rehab centers couldn't. Abigail takes a step forward until she is balanced between the bags of evidence and only inches away from me. She leans up on her toes as if she's going in for a kiss, but she sniffs at my breath instead.
"Well," she says, "will wonders never cease?"
She retraces her careful steps until she is at the threshold again.
"You're incorrect, you know. Dead men can talk. My late husband and I have a code, like that escape artist, the Jewish one."
"Houdini?"
"That's right. He's going to leave me a message, which only I can interpret, if he finds a way back from the beyond."
"You believe in that crap, Abby?" "Never would have guessed." I look up at her. "How long's he been gone?"
22 years.
"Let me guess. You two have discussions all the time." She hesitates.
"I would have evicted you years ago if not for him."
"He told you to cut me a break?"
"Well, not exactly," Abigail replies. "But he was a victor too."
She pulls the door shut behind her. "Good thing she doesn't realize my name's Virgil," I mutter, and I crouch down beside one unopened paper bag. Inside are the red polo shirt and cargo shorts that Nevi Rule was wearing when she died. The same uniform that Gideon Cartwright had been wearing that night, and Thomas Metcalf. Abby is right. Actually, dead men and women can talk. I pick up an old newspaper from a stack behind my desk and spread it out over the blotter. Then I carefully pull the red shirt and the shorts out of the bag and lay them down flat. There are stains on the fabric, blood and mud, I imagine. There are bits that are completely shredded, too, the result of the trampling. I take a magnifying glass from my desk drawer and start investigating each ragged rip. I look at the edges, trying to determine if there is any way to tell if the cut was made by a blade rather than by stretching and tearing. I do this for an hour, losing track of the holes that I have already examined.
It isn't until my third pass on the shirt that I see a tear I have not noticed before. Namely, because it isn't the fabric that was rent in two. It is a gap along a seam, as if the stitching has just unraveled where the shoulder meets the left sleeve. It is only a few centimeters in diameter, the sort of rip made when something is caught rather than torn. Looped in the stitched hem is the crescent moon of a fingernail. I flash through the image in my head, a struggle, someone grabbing onto the front of Nevi's shirt. The lab can tell us if this fingernail matched the mtDNA of Alice. And if it doesn't, we can get a sample from Thomas. And if it matches neither of them, maybe it belonged to Gideon Cartwright. I place the fingernail in an envelope. Carefully, I fold the clothing and put it back into the bag. It's then that I notice another envelope, this one with a smaller paper packet inside, as well as photos of a preserved fingerprint. The small piece of paper had been soaked with ninhydrin, leaving behind those telltale purple fingerprint ridges. These had been matched to Nevi Rule's left thumbprint, as taken by the medical examiner in the morgue. No surprise there. A receipt found in her shorts pocket would likely have her fingerprints on it. I take the small square paper out of the envelope. By now the chemical has faded, a light lavender. I can try to get the lab to process it again, to check for additional prints, but at this point they will probably be inconclusive. It isn't until I slip the paper back inside the envelope that I realize what it is. Gordon's Wholesale, it reads. And the date and time. The morning before Nevi Rule died. I didn't know which caregiver had picked up the produce orders. But maybe the employees at the wholesale outfit would remember the employees from the sanctuary. If Thomas was what Alice Metcalf had been running from, maybe all I need to do to find her is locate what she'd been running to. Alice Metcalf had seemingly vanished off the face of the earth. Had Gideon Cartwright gone with her? I didn't really mean to call Serenity. It just sort of happened. One minute I was holding the phone, and the next she was picking up on the other end. I swear, I don't even remember dialing, and I hadn't had a single drop to drink. What I wanted to ask when I heard her voice was, "Have you heard from Jenna?" I don't know why I was even concerned. I should have let her stomp off like a kid throwing a tantrum and said good riddance. Instead, I couldn't sleep at all last night. I think that's because the minute Jenna first stepped into my office, with that voice that haunted my dreams, she ripped off a band-aid so fast that I started to bleed again. Jenna may be right about one thing. This is my fault. Because I was too stupid to stand up to Donnie Boylan 10 years ago when he wanted to bury an inconsistency in the evidence. But she's wrong about another. This isn't about her finding her mother. It's about me finding my way. The thing is, I don't have a great track record with that. So there I was, holding the phone, and before I knew it, I was asking Serenity Jones, the so-called lapsed psychic, to come with me on a fact-finding mission to Gordon's Wholesale Produce Market. It wasn't until after she agreed, with game show contestant enthusiasm, to pick me up and be my de facto partner, that I understood why she was the one I'd reached out to. It wasn't that I thought she would actually be helpful in my investigation. It was because Serenity knew how it felt not to be able to live with yourself if you didn't right what you had done wrong. Now, an hour later, we're in her little sardine can of a car, driving to the edge of Boone, where Gordon's Wholesale has been in existence for as long as I can remember. It's the kind of place that sells mangoes in the dead of winter, when the whole world is dying for a mango, and the only place growing them is Chile or Paraguay. Their summertime strawberries are the size of a newborn's head. I go to turn on the radio, just because I don't know what to say, and find a little paper elephant folded and tucked into the corner. "She made that," Serenity says, and she doesn't have to say Jenna's name for me to understand. The paper slips out of my fingers like a Chinese football. It arcs in a perfect loop into Serenity's massive purple purse, which gapes open on the console between us like Mary Poppins's carpet bag. You heard from her yet today?
No.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's 8 a.m. and she's a teenager.
I squirm in the passenger seat. You don't think it was because I was an asshole yesterday?
After 10 or 11 a.m., it will be. But right now, I think it's because she's sleeping like any other kid during summer vacation.
Serenity flexes her hands on the steering wheel, and I find myself staring, not for the first time, at the furry cover she has stretched over it. It's blue, and has googly eyes and white fangs. It looks a little like the Cookie Monster, if the Cookie Monster had swallowed a steering wheel. What the hell is that thing? I ask.
Bruce,
Serenity answers, as if it's a stupid question. You named your steering wheel?
Honey, the longest relationship I've ever had is with this car. Given that your closest companion has the first name of Jack and the last name of Daniels, I don't think you're in a position to judge.
She smiles sunnily at me.
Damn, I've missed this.
Bickering?
No, police work. It's like we're Cagney and Lacey, except you're better looking than Tyne Daly.
I'm not touching that one, I mutter.
You know, in spite of what you think, what you and I do isn't all that different.
I burst out laughing. Yeah, except for that desire for measurable scientific evidence thing that I have. She ignores me.
Think about it. We both know what questions to ask. We both know what questions not to ask. We are fluent in body language. We live and breathe intuition.
I shake my head. There's no way what I do could be compared to what she does. There's nothing paranormal about my job. I don't get a vision. I focus on what's right in front of me. Detectives are observers. I see a person who can't look me in the eye, and I try to figure out whether it's grief or shame. I pay attention to what makes someone cry. I listen, even when no one's speaking words, I say. Did it ever occur to you that there is no such thing as clairvoyant? That maybe psychics are just really good at detective work?
Or maybe you've got that backward. Maybe the reason a good detective can read his subjects is because he's a little bit psychic.
She pulls into the Gordon's Wholesale parking lot. This is a fishing expedition, I tell Serenity, quickly lighting a cigarette as I get out of the car and she hurries to catch up to me. And we are going to reel in Gideon Cartwright.
You don't know where he went after the sanctuary closed?
I know he stuck around long enough to help move the elephants to their new home. And after that, your guess is as good as mine, I say. I assume that all the caregivers took turns coming here to pick up produce. If Gideon had been planning to run away with Alice, maybe he let something slip in conversation.
You don't know if the same employees are around 10 years later.
I don't know that they're not, either, I point out.
Fishing, remember? You never know what you're going to pull up when you reel in. Just go along with what I say.
I grind out my cigarette beneath my heel and walk into the produce stand. It's a glorified wooden shack staffed by lots of 20-somethings who sport dreadlocks and Birkenstocks, but there's one old man who is stacking tomatoes into a giant pyramid. It's pretty damn impressive, and at the same time, there's a perverse part of me that wants to take the one from the very bottom corner of the pile and send them all tumbling. One of the employees, a girl with a nose ring, smiles at Serenity as she hauls a big basket of sweet corn toward the cash register.
Let me know if you need any help, she says.
I've already figured that Gordon's Wholesale's decision to sell at cost to the New England Elephant Sanctuary had to have been sanctioned by whoever ran the business. And it may be ageist of me, but I'm going to assume that the old guy might know more than the dude with bloodshot eyes. I pick up a peach and take a bite.
My God, Gideon was right, I say to Serenity.
Excuse me, the man says. You can't sample the merchandise without paying.
Oh, I'll buy that peach. I'll buy the whole lot.
My friend was right. Your fruit is the best produce I've ever tasted.
He said, Marcus, if you are ever in Boone, New Hampshire, and you don't stop at Gordon's, you're doing yourself a grave disservice.
The man grins.
Well, I won't disagree with you.
He holds out a hand.
I'm Gordon Gordon.
Marcus Latoile, I reply. And this is my wife, Helga.
Serenity smiles at him.
We're on our way to a thimble convention, she says. But Marcus insisted we stop when he saw your sign.
Just then, there is a crash on the other side of a beaded curtain. Gordon sighs.
Kids today, they're all about sustainability and living green, but they don't know their ass from their elbow. Excuse me just a sec.
The minute he moves away, I round on Serenity.
A thimble convention? Helga? She counters. Plus, it was the first thing I could come up with on the spot. I wasn't expecting you to lie to the man's face.
I wasn't lying. I was doing detective work. You say what you have to say to get the confession, and people clam up around investigators because they think they're going to get into trouble, or get someone else in trouble.
And do you think psychics are charlatans?
Gordon returns, an apology on his lips.
The bok choy came in with worms.
Hate it when that happens, Serenity murmurs.
Can I interest you in some melon? Gordon says. It's like pure sugar.
I'll bet. Gideon said it was a crying shame your wares were wasted on the elephants, I tell him.
The elephants? Gordon repeats. You don't mean Gideon Cartwright.
You remember him? I say, beaming.
I can't believe it. I just can't believe it. We were roommates in college, and I haven't seen him since then. Hey, does he still live around here?
I'd love to catch up with him.
He left town a long time ago, after the elephant sanctuary closed, Gordon says.
It closed?
It was a pity. One of the employees got trampled to death. Gideon's mother-in-law, in fact.
Must have been quite a blow for him and his wife, I say, playing dumb.
That's the only blessing, really, Gordon answers. Grace died a month before it happened. She never knew.
I feel Serenity stiffen beside me. This is news to her, but I vaguely remember Gideon saying during the investigation that his wife was gone. Losing one family member is a tragedy. Losing two, back to back, seems like more than a coincidence. Gideon Cartwright had been the very picture of anguish when his mother-in-law was killed. But maybe I should have looked more closely at him as a suspect. You have any idea where he went after the sanctuary closed? I ask.
I'd love to reconnect with him, offer my condolences. I know he was headed to Nashville. That's where the elephants were going, to a sanctuary nearby. It's where Grace was buried, too.
Did you know his wife?
Sweet kid. She certainly didn't deserve to die young.
Was she sick? Serenity asks.
I suppose she was, in a fashion, Gordon says. She walked into the Connecticut River with stones in her pockets. They didn't find her body for a week.
Alice. 22 months is a long time to be pregnant. It is an enormous investment of time and energy for an elephant. Add to that the time and energy it takes to get a newborn calf to a point where it can survive on its own, and you can begin to understand what is at stake for an elephant mother. It does not matter who you are or what kind of personal relationship you've forged with an elephant. Come between her and her calf, and she will kill you. Mora had been a circus elephant that was then brought to a zoo as the mate of a male African elephant. Sparks flew, but not the way the zookeepers had intended. And small wonder, since in the wild a female elephant would never have lived with a male in close proximity. Instead, Mora charged her paramour, destroyed the fencing of the enclosure, and pinned a keeper against the fence, crushing his spinal cord. When she came to us, she was labeled a killer. Like any animal coming to the sanctuary, she had dozens of veterinary tests, including one for tuberculosis. But a pregnancy test was not part of the protocol, and so we didn't know she was going to have a calf until very nearly before it happened. When we figured it out, the swelling breasts and dropped belly, we quarantined Mora for those last couple months. It was just too risky to guess how Hester, The other African elephant in the enclosure would react, since she had never had a baby of her own. We also didn't know how much practice Mora had had as a mother until Thomas was able to locate the circus she had traveled with and learned that she had given birth once before to a male calf. It was one of a bevy of reasons that the circus had classified her as dangerous. Not wanting to risk the maternal aggression of a female elephant, they had chained her during birth so that they could take care of the newborn. But Mora had gone crazy, trumpeting, roaring, throwing her chains, trying to get to her baby. Once she was allowed to touch him, she was fine. When the calf was 2, they'd sold him to a zoo. When Thomas told me this, I'd gone out to the enclosure where Mora was grazing and sat down with my own baby playing at my feet. "I won't let it happen again," I told her. At the sanctuary, we were all excited for our own reasons. Thomas saw the money-making potential a calf would bring to the sanctuary, although, unlike a zoo that saw 10,000 more visitors as a result of a newborn elephant addition, we would not be showing the calf off. People were just more likely to give funds to support a baby. There was nothing cuter than photos of a baby elephant, the comma of its trunk dangling like an afterthought, its head poking from between the columns of its mother's legs, and we hoped our fundraising materials would be full of them. Grace had never seen a birth. Gideon and Nevi, on the other hand, had seen 2 during their time at the circus and were hoping for a happier outcome. And me? Well, I felt a kinship with this giant. Mora had made the sanctuary her home at approximately the same time I had, and I had delivered my own daughter 6 months later. Over the past 18 months, as I went out to watch Mora interacting, I would sometimes catch her eye. It's unscientific and anthropomorphic of me to say so, but off the record, I think we both felt lucky to be there. I had a beautiful baby girl and a brilliant husband. I had been able to gather data using some of Thomas's audio tapes of elephant communication that I was cobbling together into an article about grief and cognition in elephants. I got to spend every day learning from these compassionate, intelligent animals. Given that, it was easy to concentrate on the positive rather than the negative. The nights I found Thomas poring over the books, wondering how we could keep the sanctuary open. The pills he had started to take so that he could sleep at all. The fact that I had not yet documented an actual death at the sanctuary and I had been there 1.5 years. The guilt I felt over wishing for an animal to die just so that I could further my research. Then there were the arguments I got into with Nevi, who thought she knew everything because she had worked the longest with elephants. She discounted any contributions I had to make because she didn't believe the way elephants behaved in the wild could translate into sanctuary life. Some of these conflicts were minuscule. I'd prepare food for the elephants and Nevi would change the individual meals because she felt that Sira didn't like strawberries, or because Olive's stomach was upset by honeydew, although I'd seen no evidence to support either claim. But sometimes she decided to pull rank, and it affected me personally. Like, for example, when I put Asian elephant bones into the African enclosure to measure the reaction of the elephants, and she moved them away because she felt it was disrespectful to the elephants that had died. Or when she was babysitting for Jenna and insisted that it was all right to give her honey to help with teething, in spite of the fact that every parenting book I read said not to feed it to a child until 2. As soon as I brought up the issue with Thomas, he got upset. "Nevi's been with me from the start," he said, by way of explanation, as if it did not matter that I was supposed to be with him till the end. Since neither of us knew when Mora had become pregnant, her delivery date was an estimate, one on which Nevi and I disagreed. Based on the development of Mora's breasts, I knew it wasn't going to be long. Nevi insisted that births always happened at a full moon, which was 3 weeks away. I had seen one birth in the wild, although you'd think, given the sheer number of babies in the herds, I would have had the opportunity to see more. It was an elephant named Botshelo, the Tswana word for life. I happened to be tracking a different herd when I came upon hers beside a riverbed, behaving very strangely. They were typically a relaxed herd, but now they were bunched around Botshelo, facing out, protecting her. For about a half hour, there were some rumbles, and then a splash. They shifted enough for me to see Botshelo tearing at the birth sack and flipping it onto her head as if it were a lampshade and she was the life of the party. In the grass beneath her was the tiniest little elephant, a female, surrounded by an explosion of sound, rumbling, trumpeting, chaos. The herd urinated, they secreted, and as they rolled the whites of their eyes at me, it was almost as if they were trying to get me to celebrate. The baby was touched from tip to toe by every member of the herd. Botshelo put her trunk around the calf and under the calf and in her calf's mouth. Hello. Welcome. The calf was rolling on her side, discombobulated, her legs starfished in all directions. Botshelo used her feet and her trunk to lift the calf. The baby would manage to get her front end up, only to have it crash forward when her back end lifted, or vice versa, a tripod with the legs at odd lengths. Finally, Botshelo knelt, pressing her face against the head of the calf, and then stood, as if she was trying to show her baby how to do it. When the calf tried and slipped, Botshelo kicked up enough grass and dirt to give her more stable footing. After 20 minutes of Botshelo's intense ministrations, that little baby wobbled along at her mother's side, Botshelo's trunk pulling her up every time she tipped over. Eventually, the baby took refuge beneath her mother, her floppy trunk pressed up against her mother's belly as she rooted to nurse. The whole process of birth was matter of fact, abbreviated, and also the most incredible experience I had ever witnessed. One morning, when I went out to check on Mora, as I had made it my habit to do, with Jenna strapped to my back like a papoose, I noticed a bulge at the elephant's bottom. I four-wheeled to the Asian barn where Nevi and Thomas were talking about a fungus that one of the elephants had developed on her toenails. "It's time," I said, breathlessly. Thomas acted like he had when I had told him my own water had broken. He started running around, excited, scattered, overwhelmed. He radioed Grace and asked her to come and take Jenna back to our cottage and sit with her while the rest of us went to the African enclosure.
"There's no rush," Nevi insisted. "I've never heard of an elephant giving birth during the day. It happens at night, so that the baby's eyes can adjust."
If it took that long for Mora, I knew it meant that something would be wrong. Her body was already showing all the signs of advanced labor. "I think we have a half an hour, tops," I said. I watched Thomas's face turn from Nevi's to mine, and then he radioed Gideon.
"Meet us at the African barn, ASAP," he said.
And I turned away when I felt Nevi's gaze on me. The mood at first was celebrative. Thomas and Gideon argued over whether it would be better for the calf to be male or female. Nevi talked about what it was like when she delivered Grace. They joked about whether an elephant could have drugs during the birth, and if it would be called a pachydural. Me, I focused on Mora. As she rumbled, suffering through contractions, an auditory current of sisterhood flew through the grounds of the sanctuary. Hester trumpeted back to Mora, then the Asian elephants, at a further distance, checked in. A half hour had passed since I first told Thomas to come quickly, then an hour. After 2 hours of moving in circles, Mora had still not progressed. "Maybe we should call the vet," I suggested. But Nevi waved me off. "I told you," she said. "It'll happen after sunset." I knew of plenty of rangers who'd seen elephants give birth at all times of the day, but I bit my tongue. I wished that Mora were in the wild, if only so that one of her herd could communicate that there was nothing to worry about, that everything was going to be all right. 6 hours later, though, I had my doubts. By then, Gideon and Nevi had both gone to prepare and distribute food for the Asian elephants and Hester. We may have been having a birth, but there were still 6 other elephants that needed care. I think you should call the vet, I told Thomas as I watched Mora stumble, weary. Something's wrong. Thomas didn't hesitate.
I'll check on Jenna and make the call.
He looked at me, troubled.
Will you stay with Mora?
I nodded and sat down on the far side of the fence, my knees drawn up, to watch Mora suffer. I had not wanted to say this out loud, but all I could think of was Kahiso, the elephant I had found with a dead calf shortly before I left Africa. I did not even want to think of her, for superstitious fear that I might jinx this birth. Not more than 5 minutes after Thomas left, Mora pivoted, presenting her hindquarters to me so that I could clearly see the amniotic balloon extending from between her legs. I scrambled to my feet, torn between wanting to get Thomas and knowing that I wouldn't have time. Before I could even equivocate, the entire amniotic sac slipped out in a gush and rush of fluid, and the calf landed on the grass, still caught in its white caul. If Mora had sisters in a herd, they would be telling her what to do. They would encourage her to tear the sack, to help that baby stand. But Mora had no one but me. I cupped my hand over my mouth and tried to mimic the distress call, the SOS I had heard elephants make when a predator was in the area. I hoped I could shock Mora into action. It took 3 tries, but finally, Mora used her trunk to tear at the sack. I knew, though, even as she did, that something was wrong. Unlike the jubilation of Botchello and her herd, Mora's body was hunched. Her eyes were downcast, her mouth drooped. Her ears were low and flat against her body. She looked like Kahiso, when Kahiso's calf was dead. Mora tried to pull the small, stillborn male to his feet. She pushed at him with her front foot, but he did not move. She tried to curl her trunk around the body and lift him, but he slipped from her grasp. She pulled away the afterbirth and then rolled the body of the calf. She was still bleeding, streaks down her rear legs as dark and pronounced as the secretions from her temporal glands. But she continued to dust and shove the calf, which had not taken a single breath. I was in tears by the time Thomas arrived again, Gideon in tow, with the news that the vet would arrive within the hour. The whole sanctuary had gone silent and still. The other elephants had stopped calling. Even the wind had died. The sun had turned its face into the shoulder of the landscape, and in the custom of mourning, the fabric of the night had been ripped, revealing a star at each tiny tear. Mora stood over the body of her son, her body an umbrella, shielding him.
"What happened?"
Thomas said. And for the rest of my life, I would always think that he had been accusing me. I shook my head. "Call back the vet," I said. "He doesn't need to be here yet." By now, the bleeding had stopped. There wasn't anything that could be done.
"He'll want to do a necropsy on the calf."
"Not until she's done grieving," I said. And the word triggered my silent wish of just days ago, that one of these elephants would die so that I could continue my postdoc research. I felt as if I had subconsciously willed this. Maybe Thomas was right to accuse me. "I'm going to stay here," I announced. Thomas stepped forward.
"You don't have to."
"This is what I do," I said, tightly.
"What about Jenna?"
I saw Gideon take a step away as our voices escalated. What about her? I asked.
You're her mother.
And you're her father. For this one night in a year of Jenna's life, I could pass up putting my baby to bed so that I could watch Mora stand over hers. This was my job. Had I been a doctor, this would have been the equivalent of being paged for an emergency. But Thomas wasn't paying attention.
I was counting on that calf,
he murmured.
It was going to save us.
Gideon cleared his throat.
Thomas, how about I take you back to the cottage? And I'll have Grace bring a sweater to Alice.
After they left, I took notes, marking the times Mora ran her trunk along the spine of the calf and her listless toss of the amniotic sac. I wrote down the differences in her vocalizations, from a cooing rumble of reassurance to the call of a mother trying to get her calf to return to her side, but it was a one-sided conversation. Grace returned with a sweater and a sleeping bag and sat with me for a while in silence, just watching Mora and feeling her sadness. It's heavier here, she remarked. The air. Although I knew that the barometric pressure could not be affected by the death of an elephant, I understood what she meant. The quiet pushed in at the soft spot at the bottom of my throat, in my eardrums, threatening to suffocate us. Nevi came to pay her respects, too. She didn't say anything, just handed me a bottle of water and a sandwich, and stood a distance away, seemingly shuffling through a deck of memories she didn't want to share. Just as I was nodding off at 3 a.m, Mora finally stepped away from the calf. She scooped the baby up in her trunk, but it slipped out of her grasp twice. She tried to lift it by its neck, and failing that, its legs. After several aborted attempts, she managed to curl the body of the baby under her trunk, the way she might lift a bale of hay. Carefully, slowly, Mora started to walk north. In the distance, I could hear a contact call from Hester. Mora responded softly, muted, as if she were worried about waking the calf. Gideon and Nevi had taken the four-wheelers when they left, so I had no choice but to travel on foot. I didn't know where Mora was headed, so I did exactly what I shouldn't have done. I ducked through the opening in the gate made for the vehicles and walked in the shadows behind her. Luckily, Mora was either too lost in her own grief or too focused on her precious load to notice me, slinking along behind the trees as quietly as possible. We walked 20 yards between us, past the pond and through the birch woods and across a meadow until Mora reached the spot where she liked to come at the hottest part of the day. Underneath a sprawling oak was a carpet of pine needles. Mora would lie on her side and nap in the shade. Today, though, she placed the calf there and began to cover him with branches, breaking off pine boughs and kicking up fallen needles and tufts of moss until the corpse was partially covered. Then she stood over him again, making a pillared temple of her body. And I worshipped. I prayed. 24 hours after Mora had delivered the calf, I had still not slept, and neither had she. More critically, she had not had any sustenance. Although I knew she could go without food for a little while, she had to have water. So when Gideon found me, safely on the far side of the fencing again, I asked him for a favor. I needed him to bring back one of the shallow tubs we used for foot soaks in the barns and 5 half-gallon jugs of water. When I heard the ATV approach behind me, I looked at Mora to see if she'd react. Usually, the African elephants were curious when it was feeding time. But Mora didn't even turn her head in the direction of Gideon's approach. As he idled to a stop on the path, I said, Get off. What I was doing would have been strictly forbidden in the game reserve, because I was planning to adjust the ecosystem. It was also